The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Angela Duckworth. Angela is the Christopher H. Brown Distinguished Professor of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Her book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, was a New York Times bestseller. She is a 2013 MacArthur Genius Fellow and has advised such noteworthy groups as the White House, the World Bank, and even the NBA. Angela, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thank you so much.
So in working at Second City for so many years, and I've been there nearly 30 years, I've worked with all these talented people, and I've been asked probably 1,000 times if there's a defining characteristic that I've seen in all the future stars I worked with, people like Amy Poehler and Seth Meyers and Tina Fey and Stephen Colbert. And I've been very lucky to work with all these people. And it's, for me, it's never been about IQ or even a thing like natural talent. It's always been about an ability to operate with immense comfort and ease in an entirely messy artistic pursuit. And I never labeled that as grit, but I think it shares some of those qualities.
So interesting. And I noticed that in, you know, I don't know if I can broadly call it the entertainment industry, people use the word talent a lot. Like, oh, has a talent show? Not yet. Send them to hair and makeup. I mean, it's a word that's used in all different ways. I appreciate your observation. I'm obviously biased, I guess. I'm not surprised. But I wonder, when you say I work with a lot of talented people, how do you use that word? I think people use it differently.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up because you're reading my notes. That's my follow-up because you seek to demystify talent, and I think we use it as a crutch. And I do think what your book sort of exposed for me is we've let that term become a meaning that is not true. Because, you know, we don't, when these people enter Second City, they have lots of different gifts, and many of them very different. And much of what we're teaching them are the conditions and behaviors that they need and want to have to take that talent and bring it to the next level. So a lot of that is about focus. A lot of that is about listening. And a lot of that is about resilience. You know this about comedy, right? It's failing over and over and over again in front of audiences until you get it right. And you build a muscle that's okay with that. And I've seen people, here's a good example. Steve Carell was in the Second City system for almost a decade before anyone was talking about him. Whereas someone like, Chris Farley was a superstar the minute he was on stage. They, you know, you can argue about the level of talent with each of them or whatever. You know, again, that word again maybe trips us up. But the individual, each individual sort of operates differently. That, and I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. And so, that's really interesting. And I think it's interesting. Comedy, dance, a lot of things that most of humanity doesn't do, at least as a profession. I think those sports, you know, professional sports, those are the things where we use talent, a lot of gift. There's something different about Amy Poehler or Tina Fey. Like, I'll never have that, but they do. Whereas I think behind the scenes, you do see a lot of failure, a lot of they weren't actually that great with timing. Now they're a little better. Oh, now they're a little better. Oh, now they're a little better. Now their timing is actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. I guess the way that you're using talent, do you just mean how good they are? I mean, how funny a comedian is? How? Because for me, I think of that as, I think I use the word skill for that, which is a lot less sexy.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've realized myself that when I say skill and I say talent, I might be using those words differently. And that is not to say that I'm right. It's just to say that I think it can cause some confusion if I'm using words differently than others. And I don't want to stick too much on that point, but it's just an interesting observation.
Well, I think what, you know, yeah, and what you write, because you, I think it's an important point, you say that, and I quote you, talent is no guarantee of grit. And I think that's important. And I'd like you to sort of expand on that concept, because I think it's connected to what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. So I define talent, and again, this is Angela Duckworth. This isn't, I'm not mandating this for anybody else. But I think an intuition and the dazzle, the glamour of the word talent, it does suggest some kind of innate gift that you are born with, and it makes it really easy for you to pick up a skill. So if, you know, Steph Curry, to take an athletic example, or mm-hmm. Steve Carell in comedy, if they have a comedy gene or a comedy talent, it means that they get really, really good at comedy or whatever else it is fast. That's what I mean by talent. And I think if you say, all right, Angela Duckworth, that's the way you're using talent, then you could ask, okay, these people who pick things up so quickly, they're just the rapid performer, the rapid improvers. Are they the ones who show up early, stay late, ask for feedback, hungry to know what they can do better? My research suggests that no, not always. And in fact, often the very most talented individuals are a little less tenacious, hardworking, you know, eager to improve than others. I wonder if that's your observation. Happy to hear that it's not, but if it is or if it isn't, I wonder what you think about that.
Wow, this I didn't expect the. Okay, I'm fascinated by this conversation. So it's both. There are obviously people who come in who are fabulously successful in comedy, who are notoriously lazy and don't do the extra work. But that, I think, it tends to be a bit of the outlier. And recognize this, too, at Second City, it's not an individual pursuit. It's an ensemble pursuit. So to be successful there, you have to not only have your individual stuff together, but then yeah. you are responsible to this greater group. So the tie-in I was seeing with what you're talking about is when you talk about the Green Berets and you talk about the cadets at West Point, to me, I'm like, that feels to me very much like what happens when you come into the sort of ensemble system at Second City, where you have to pick up on ideas like making your partner look good, never being late for a show, the ability to act agile and pivot in real time. There's a real sort of like play between System 1, System 2 thinking in your brain. And then most of all is surviving through all of it, because it really is, it ends up being sort of this endurance test. And it also mostly doesn't happen right away. You're at Second City between training and then hopefully getting in one of the touring companies to a professional company. You know, it's like it can be like a 6 or 8 year process. And I think you talk a lot about in Grid about, you know, the need for this stuff to evolve over time.
Yeah, I think that a couple of things. One is, I don't think grit's the only thing you need to be successful at anything. We already talked about talent, and I think yeah. talent really does matter. If you're a really slow learner in something, even if you have 10 times as long to improve with feedback compared to the girl or the guy next to you, I don't think you should be doing that thing. Yeah. Do something else. So talent matters. Luck matters. One of the things that you mentioned about, you know, how do I make my partner look good? Mm-hmm. How do I get along with these, like, 7 people I've never met? That's not grit either. I wouldn't even call that talent. I mean, I think that's a social and emotional intelligence, you could call it. Mm-hmm. EQ, sometimes people call it. I think you don't need that to be a great chess player, but you do need that to do many, many other things in life, including things that you care a lot about. So I completely agree with you if you are saying or just pointing out that, you know, as important or interesting as grit is as a success predictor, it is by no means the only predictor. And the second thing I'm picking up on in your conversation that I want to amplify and I want to say clearly is that I really believe that even if you're talking about the people who are, you know, the slackers who seem to effortlessly get up and be funny, or, you know, the naturals maybe who they just hit it and they appear to do no practice at all, whether or not that's entirely true, I do think there's something about sticking around in a field long enough to get anywhere. You know what I mean? Like how it just things take time. I just it's very hard for me to believe, but I think young people often do believe that you could do something for a year or two, and you know magic happens. I think that's a myth.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. And indeed, the image I've got in mind of some of the people who I would call a bit lazy, it's not that they're not there. They're there all the time. That's part of the problem. They're, you know, they're at the bar. They're hanging out after the show. And the one thing I'm sort of thinking about with what you're saying is there is something about being present in the place of the thing that you want that, you know, and I say that to people. The first advice I got when I said I wanted to be in theater was the founder of Second City. I got to meet with him before he passed away, and he said, then be in a theater, doing whatever it is. You tearing tickets. And for me, I was a dishwasher at Second City. It was my first gig. And I stayed. So
how old were you?
I was 21. It was my first job out of college. And the other dishwasher who was hired that same week was the director, Jon Favreau.
Wow, those are some pretty, those are dishwashers going somewhere. But you know the famous Woody Allen saying that 80% of success in life is showing up. Mm-hmm. If you don't show up, you've struck out at the very first level. And of course, this was his advice to other aspiring screenwriters who said that they were writing on their screenplay, or novelists who promised Woody Allen they were writing their book. And his advice was write the book, you know, stick around. So that's why I study grit, I think, in large part. But I also want to point out that, you know, obviously you can't stick with everything. I mean, many of us did something when we were 9 years old, and we're very glad we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You have to quit things in life. But I do worry about those grown-ups who seem not to ever stick to anything, and I think it's a very dissatisfying life for many of them.
Yeah, yeah. You had this great quote that I saw in a New York Times blog where you talked about it being okay for, like, kids to quit, but you said, but you can't quit on a hard day.
Yeah, I think this is partly from my experience being a mom of a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old. And, you know, both they and I, and sometimes my husband, you know, have this impulse to throw in the towel on especially bad days. And, you know, we all know what it's like to have a rough day. It's just, you know, those days that they're not fun. Somebody yelled at you. You got into an argument. You got criticized. You screwed up. And I think those are the moments, those low points, where the emotion seizes us and we want to make the pain stop and we want to quit basketball or whatever it is that we're doing. I think on those days, we should say to ourselves, this would be the very worst time to make a decision.
Right.
You talk about system one and system two, the more impulsive versus the more reflective ways that people can think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're very reflective. We're not very fair-minded when we're in pain. So don't quit on a bad day.
Yeah.
Quit on a good day. If you still want to quit on a good day, you should probably quit.
Yeah, it's the thing I was connecting to, because my kids are 14 and 19, my wife's been involved with Second City as well. So they studied and did improv games their entire life. And I don't know if you know the stuff emanates for these improv games, which are the sort of foundation of the work at Second City and all improvisational work in America right now, pretty much, came from a woman named Viola Spolden, who was a social worker at Jane Addams Hull House, who invented the games as a way to help the immigrant children in her care better collaborate and empathize and communicate with each other.
I did not know that. That is unbelievably fascinating.
Isn't it cool? And then her son, Paul Sills, was studying at the University of Chicago, totally dug these games, taught them to his friends, Mike Nichols, Elaine May, and that turned into The Second City. It remained, and this was funny about it, was my wife was actually running the training center when my son was old enough to go to summer camp or need to go to summer camp, and we took him to, like, the Old Town School of Folk Music here in Chicago, and they were teaching him improv. And we're like, wait a sec, we work at Second City. So we started doing these summer camps and re-inviting sort of children to take the classes. And it has been an amazing experience because we've worked with kids on the spectrum. We get a lot of kids who are a little bit kind of in trouble or, you know, the parents just need them to get out of their shell. And even though, you know, we're not sort of trained sociologists, the games themselves are you know, improv is a pedagogy. So they are learning while doing focus exercises, right? And give and take exercises. So it is really sort of. I think we're at an interesting point now to take this stuff back into the lab and get some data on it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's interesting. You know, one of the parallels that you may have observed or thought about already is that little kids, 3, 4 years old, do a lot of quote unquote improv. I mean, they're doing pretend play.
Totally.
It, you know, sometimes it's called dramatic, you know, now I'm a dinosaur. Okay, you be the dinosaur mom and I'll be the, you know, now this is a spaceship. They make up these narratives that are historically impossible. But the question is, why do young children spontaneously do it if nobody asks them to do it? And actually, nobody models it for them. They just do it.
Yep.
One of the thoughts is that the development of imagination, you know, being able to think about things that are not right in front of you, not in the here and now, is a crucial human competence. It helps us with all kinds of things, including self-control, which doesn't seem to be something that you would develop through improv, but maybe you do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think that's very, very interesting. And I, you know, am associated with hard work, but I'll tell you that I think there's a huge role for play. You know, all animals, not just human beings, all of us play, and I think it's, you know, not the world that I want to see is where people learn how to work hard at something that they love to do and they get better and they learn how to get up after they fall down. But I also want to see a world where people do things that they're fun and sometimes frivolous. And I think the message of grit is that to develop a real lifelong passion, especially in the beginning, requires a ton of play.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask you: what's the difference between resilience and grit for you?
For me, and again, speaking for myself, since I can't speak for everyone, I think of resilience as one thing that helps you be gritty. It's impossible to be gritty when bad things happen to you if you're not resilient, because resilience is coming back from adversity. Having, you know, literally that kind of pliability. But it's not the only thing you need to be gritty.
Mm-hmm.
You can be resilient and not have a passion. You know, you can have resilience but not say, God, I have this thing that I wake up. You know, to me, I woke up at 5 this morning, and what was I thinking about? I was thinking about my work.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody asked me to think about my work. Nobody. That's not resilience. That's having an obsession, a voluntary obsession, if you will, something that I also think is important to humanity in its small way. So I think resilience is a key component of what I think of as grit, but it's not enough to be gritty.
Yeah, well, okay, so that seems like it connects directly to the people who show up and decide to take that first improv class at Second City, which is a very brave act, right? It's a very vulnerable place to be. And what they're doing, they become very passionate about the work in the community, and they're getting all this practice, basically failure practice, over and over and over again. And we had Charles Lim in the other day for the podcast, who's the guy who actually put freestyle rappers in the MRI machine to see what happened to the brain when they were improvising as opposed to when they were doing sort of memorized pieces. And what he discovered, and I you know better than I in terms of the terms, I don't have them at hand, but essentially a part of our brain that shames or self-censors dramatically goes down when people are improvising. And so much of our work is when we deal with like businesses and adults is kind of unlearning to that quality of being afraid to look foolish, and I think that
you know,
that
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm definitely not an expert on those parts of the brain or maybe any parts of the brain, but I will say this, that it's amazing how if bad we are at failure, you know. And if you look at 1, 2, 3-year-olds, really all the way up to around the time that kids go to school, kindergarten, they're great at failing. I mean, how many times does a toddler fall down? They're not ashamed. They're not embarrassed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like a kid falls down when they're 9 months old and never tries to walk again. But there are a lot of us as grown-ups who would do anything before we would fall out flat on our face, especially in front of other people. So it's interesting to think about drama or improv as a kind of high-intensity, high-exposure failure training, maybe to get us back to our, you know, 3- and 4-year-old selves. But if there's anything that I think makes me a reasonably successful scientist, I am not afraid to fail. Like, I am not afraid to look dumb. I'm not afraid to say, I don't know what that word is. What's mm-hmm. that word? What's that part of the brain? Tell me again. I'm confused. Wait, no, tell me again. Sorry, you're going to tell me one more time. I don't get it. I think if you do that every day, you're going to learn something. And those are the people who I think in any domain end up, they get all the lessons that are out there, and so many people miss out on those lessons because they're afraid.
Yeah. And you talked about, and this was in regard to teaching, I believe, 7th grade math. And I'm like, my daughter is going through this right now because she's applying and doing all the testing for selective enrollment high schools in Chicago. And it's kind of a nightmare. But you actually said, could it be that the struggling student needed to struggle just a little bit longer? And I love that because, you know, a term I use when I talk about improvisation is it allows you to sort of mindfully linger inside a mistake and play with it a little bit. And I think that what you're pointing out is that struggle is part of the process, and letting them stay there is a good thing. And certainly the sort of helicopter parenting has so many people pulling their kids out at the first sign of a mistake or a failure.
Yeah. And I, you know, I would be lying if I didn't say that I felt great empathy for this, because I'm oftentimes that parent who, you know, who wants to see their darling daughter or son suffer. You know, it's natural instinct to go pick up their history book, make sure that their terrible math teacher gets an earful, so they're not mm-hmm. so terrible, and help them with that essay, you know, that they're crying over. And I don't think pain itself is the objective, but I do think that kids only learn from consequences at some point. I mean, if you bubble wrap your kids, they will miss out on a bunch of lessons, and they will, yeah, the kind of discomfort that I think as a, you know, I'm thinking of Ta-Nehisi Coates, right, the writer who I had to stalk to get him to. I knew that I could use his words in my book under fair use law, but I kind of felt icky about it. So I tracked him down. Eventually he emailed me back, and I'm quite gritty and didn't give up. And we were talking about Between the World and Me, and he said he wrote it 5 times. I mean, you know, and I said, God, that's 5 times the amount of suffering that I can think of for writing my own book, which is a lot of suffering.
Right.
I said, you know what? I actually love the challenge. And I think that what we love our young people to grow up to be is the kind of person who develops, I think, yeah, that appetite to linger mindfully in an error and to explore all its contours and to come out the other side in one piece and not take themselves too seriously. And most important, to learn from it. I mean, if you can approach challenge that way, think how much Ta-Nehisi Coates must have learned every time he rewrote that book, every time the book was, in his own words, you know, like his own writing, horrible. I just think that that's, that requires a little self-discipline on the part of the parents, because it requires you to maybe not immediately extinguish the discomfort for your kid, which a big part of you wants to do.
Yeah, I had not considered prior to reading your book this relationship between a passion and resiliency, kind of forming, you know, gritty behavior. And when you wrote that you should foster a passion rather than follow a passion, I love that because what you're really talking about is this sort of over a period of time continuing to cultivate and work and practice at it rather than just sort of this ethereal thing that you're just going to get one day and you're done. And none of the great artists that we've talked about ever stopped doing their work. They had two qualities. I think Tina Fey was like this a lot. She was always, we have a phrase, that play the scene you're in. She was always fiercely present mm-hmm. in the moment, but never afraid to take the big leap when that call came. So when she got the call to go to Saturday Night Live, she was gone the next day. And it doesn't mean mm-hmm. that the day before she wasn't right there doing the work that was in front of her. She was. So it was really sort of this duality that she was able to have. That feels gritty to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually live close to where Tina Fey went to high school. They have her in the Upper Darby
High School
Hall of Fame.
I didn't know that's where
yeah.
you are. It's hilarious.
Well, we're, you know, Philadelphia, which is getting discounts. And,
sure.
And so I've walked by her Hall of Fame picture. And if I had a time machine, I would love to go back in time through the decades to see what she was like when she was 17, 16, 15. What about 10? What was she like when she was 9 or 8? You know, it is true that some people retrospectively will say, the moment I stepped out on stage, I knew. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was like, I didn't have to think about it for the rest of my life. I knew I was going to be a performer. I think for many people, the reality is that they were kind of bumping along and, oh, my God, there's nothing left for eighth period electives. I guess I'll take this drama class. One thing leads to another. My point about fostering a passion as opposed to following it, expecting it to be like a thunderbolt and you just know all in a moment, is that I think for many, many people, it is a little more gradual.
Yep.
It wasn't something you could have predicted. And what I worry about is kids who don't have parents like yours. I mean, my guess is that you were very intentional and awesome about making sure your kids got to experience a lot of things. They could develop interest. If you think about kids who are growing up in disadvantage, and I'm not just talking about economic disadvantage, but just, you know, families that don't quite have it together, mm-hmm. they're not getting that exposure. Where is a kid going to fall in love with and stay in love with pastry arts if they're never exposed to it, you know? So I think that a lot of passion comes from sustained experience. And so we should be, you know, we yuppie parents should continue to do that for our kids. I would wish the same for all kids, I guess.
Yeah, and if you've seen Tina's photo there, you probably have a good idea of, you know, that there was an evolution over time. 'Cause she...
Yeah. Right.
I mean, she talks about, like, just the, you know, no dating. She was such a tomboy. She also, I don't know if you know the story of when she was a small child about the cut she received on her face.
I don't know that one.
Oh, well, this is actually
book.
This is so what happened was when Tina was a little girl, and I forget the age, but she was a young girl. The doorbell rang. She opened it and someone sliced her face with a razor and then ran away. So she has a scar.
I didn't know that.
Yep. So she has a scar, and she conceives of herself as having what she would call a deformity. So she would use that, and basically, I think one of the reasons she sort of fell into comedy was sort of as a self-defense mechanism as she was sort of getting older to compensate for this scar that she had in her face. And I mean, she has so many incredible qualities. Great parents who totally fed her, a brother who shared a lot of arts and interest in music with, and so she had all this stuff around her, and then to see her evolution, because I met her when she was around 22 or so, and to see her blossom into, and she's, this is the amazing thing, as glamorous as she is today and as successful as she is today, her personality traits have not changed really at all in my experience. She's lovely and sarcastic and strong and introverted and all those things. And I think it's what makes her work so, you know, resonant for people, because it's very authentic. They see themselves like, oh, this is a person who lived a real human life. But you're exactly right that it evolved over time. With Tina Fey, there was no thunderbolt.
It's so interesting. Well, I'm so glad that one of the people I admire most is actually a really nice person. It's nice that at least some of the people turn out to be as wonderful in real life as they are in your mind's eye. But yeah, I think that in my own lab here, I say to the young PhDs, you know, hashtag work in progress, mm-hmm. because that's what they are, and that's what I am, and that's what their screwed-up parents are, and that's what my screwed-up parents are. And, you know, I think that, you know, this idea of growth mindset, I think the idea that we, and this isn't scientifically shown to be true, but maybe it's also common sense, we want our kids to think of themselves as works in progress, making a lot of mistakes, pretty good people at heart, always learning, always learning. If you can hold on to that as an identity, you know, always a work in progress, I think no matter what you do in life, it's a tremendously healthy way to keep moving forward.
Yep, absolutely. So we end the podcast usually with a question, and the question is this. Do you have a yes and story in your life? So in improv, the whole idea is you can't say no, and you can't just say yes. You have to say yes and everything on stage. You have to affirm and contribute so you can explore and heighten. And what we find with many of our guests is that they have sort of, you know, times in their life, either when they're young or in college or early in their career, when they had that moment where a no would normally come out of their mouth and instead a yes and did. I'm wondering if you've got one of those.
I think I may be one of those people who says yes and too much. Because I think my whole life, I just did whatever the hell I wanted. Most recently, I'll tell you this, that, you know, I decided to start a nonprofit organization to advance the work in not just grit, but other things that I think matter hugely, gratitude and generosity and kindness and curiosity, all things that I would call character. And I could have quit my job as a professor, but I didn't want to do that. And I don't want, but I said, yes, and I am going to be an Ivy League professor, and I am going to raise millions of dollars and run this nonprofit and deliver things to kids that make their lives better. And that instantiated or set off a whole chain of other yes ands. So I'm very busy, but I think yes ands are a great way to live life.
That's awesome. Angela Duckworth, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.